I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Governor Larry Hogan continues to enjoy high approval ratings statewide, and he's got lots of people encouraging him to challenge Donald Trump in 2020. Today, an update on the governor's more immediate concern, the Maryland General Assembly. With 6 weeks left in this year's session and more than 2,000 bills and counting, we'll run down the status of some key pieces of legislation as they work their way through the House and Senate. A $15 minimum wage, a private police force for Johns Hopkins, gender-neutral IDs, and local control of the school calendar. We'll talk about the latest from Annapolis with Washington Post politics reporter Ovita Wiggins and Baltimore Sun Statehouse reporter Luke Broadwater. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The King and I at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore. That's all coming up on Midday, right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us today. We begin with an update from the General Assembly in Annapolis. The session began last month on January 9th. A day later, Senate President Mike Miller announced that he has been diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer. He is being treated with chemotherapy. Governor Larry Hogan's inauguration followed a week later, and since then, the governor has been openly encouraged by many to consider a run for the 2020 Republican presidential nomination. He delivered an upbeat State of the State address at the end of last month, and today we are a little less than a month away from Crossover Day, the deadline for the House and Senate to send bills to each other that they intend to pass before the session ends on the 8th. Of April. I am joined on Midday by two terrific reporters who are longtime friends of our little program. Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics and government for the Washington Post. Hey, Ovita, how you doing?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
And Luke Broadwater covers the State House for the Baltimore Sun. Luke, welcome back as well.
Hi, Ovita. Hi, Tom.
So, Ovita, let's start with you. Senate President Miller's health. He is undergoing chemotherapy, but he, you know, when he made this very dramatic announcement at the beginning of the session, he vowed to stay at work. How's that going?
Well, he has been, he's missed a few days, but he's been his normal self, I guess you could say. He's lost a little weight. He's lost quite a bit of hair. Today, Senate President Pro Tem Kathy Klausmeier actually led the session, and the Senate President came in a little late. He sat on the floor, so he's been doing that a little bit. That's one difference. But he seems to be doing pretty well, and as you said, he said that he plans to be here as often as he can and to continue throughout the session.
And Luke Broadwater, I mean, is it having a palpable effect on the rhythm of the place, the vibe, the amount of work that's getting done? Is his illness, holding things up, hampering things in any way legislatively?
I would say no. I think, he's not present as much, but the Senate President Miller is here the vast majority of the time. He's still his same fiery self. He still gets his way about things. Ovita and colleagues had a great story in the Post in which he had some very salty comments about his remaining power. So I do not think there has been any change to the direction of legislation or anything like that because of his cancer.
Well, we all certainly wish him the best on what, of course, is a very tough road. So, Ovita, the governor gave a very upbeat State of the State address, emphasizing the bipartisan cooperation and holding up Maryland as a paradigm for other states. And ever since he won this election back in November, many people are openly encouraging him to run for president. How's he responding to those reports?
Well, he has, on yesterday, he actually was on CBS this morning, in which he talked about the number of people who are encouraging him to run. And his response to that was, I'm not shutting the door on them. I'm not throwing them out of my office. So he is seriously considering a run against President Trump, but he has also said that he would not enter the race unless he thought that he could win. He talked about during that interview, talked about how he does see President Trump as being pretty weak in a general election, but the problem with for anyone who's considering running against him would be trying to mount a race in the primary. And the president at this point has great support. And I think that there are those, including the governor, who's looking at he's looking at the polling numbers, of course, looking to see whether the president is weakened any further than what he is right now.
And Ovidia, is there any sign that he's, you know, raising money, talking to anybody about, you know, potential donors, potential financial support for a possible run?
Well, he has not said anything about actually getting to that level of raising money. He's been meeting with all of the folks who are encouraging him to run next month. Early next month, he'll be out in Iowa for an NGA event, but he's also planning to do some events, you know, meeting with additional folks out there. So yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and of course, the National Governors Association, he's about to take over the chairmanship of that August assemblage. And Luke Broadwater, it seems to me at least that there is a bit of a different tone by the governor regarding President Trump. You know, a year or so ago when he was on this show, we talked about Trump and he sort of dismissed Trump. He said, you know, I just don't think about him. He doesn't think about me and he's sort of irrelevant. But lately, particularly in these national television appearances that he's been making, and he's made a bunch. I mean, Ovidia mentioned CBS this morning. He's been on CNN and other channels as well. He's less reticent about going after the president for specific things. I mean, the national emergency declaration, for example. Do you get a sense that he's changing? He's ramping up the rhetoric a little bit and changing his tune?
I think that's right, and I think it's a gradual change. You know, I think during his first term, he was very reluctant to criticize the president by name. And in fact, the only times he generally did so were when he was asked or pressed by reporters. Right after winning his second term, I took note, and I think others in the press corps and other political observers did as well, that he volunteered a criticism of Trump by name the next day, saying that he was, quote, an albatross around the neck of the party and he had dragged down so many Republicans to defeat. So I certainly noticed that, and I think he is doing it more. Now, what does that mean functionally? Does that just mean we'll have a little bit more of a combative Larry Hogan with the president? Does it mean that he's actually really seriously considering a run? In my view, so far, we've seen no functional steps towards taking a run, nothing really solid. You know, he's not doing the things that Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and other people are actually doing to run. He is, I think, enjoying TV interviews and maybe enjoying the attention some. But he does have some time. You know, I talked with several analysts for a story I did a few weeks back about he probably doesn't really need to make a decision till the end of summer to get ramped up. But as of right now, there's been nothing concrete in terms of really getting together a campaign or anything like that.
And Ovidia Wiggins, in terms of his State of the State address, he mentioned things like tax cuts, like redistricting. Are the priorities that he outlined at that speech a week after the session started, are they moving ahead? It seems to me that perhaps some of those priorities are taking a back seat to some of the other legislation we're hearing about, things like the $15 minimum wage, et cetera. I mean, are the governor's priorities, is he having any success pushing those things that he seemed to think were important?
I think that's right. Your assessment is right. Most of his priorities have taken a back seat to many of the issues that are on the Democratic agenda. I know that prior to session starting, he met privately with the Senate President and the House Speaker to talk about, you know, once again, his message of bipartisanship and hoping to move forward on some of the pieces of legislation that he has had introduced in years past. The Senate recently moved on a bill that dealt with drunk drivers. It's a bill that the governor has on his agenda and has put in previous years. The Senate recently passed that measure. But the interesting thing is that they also passed it last year as well. The Senate did, but it did not move in the House. So there hasn't been much movement at this point on the bills that he put forward. You mentioned redistricting. We can pretty much say today that that's not going to happen because there's no interest from the legislature to move on that, given that there's the Supreme Court ruling.
Right, that's pending in a case that Maryland and one other state have before the Supreme Court. Luke Broadwater, if Governor Hogan does decide to run for president, there's a legislator in Annapolis, Bill Ferguson, who has introduced a bill hoping to hasten the demise of the Electoral College. Tell us about that.
Right. So more than a decade ago, Governor O'Malley and others entered into a multi-state compact in which that would shift Maryland's votes to the winner of the popular vote, Maryland's Electoral College votes to the winner of the popular vote, if enough states went along with it. They needed more than 270 total Electoral College votes to make that happen. That hasn't happened. Only 12 states have entered into the compact. And so Senator Ferguson has this idea where it would go to a pairing system in which Maryland and, say, Wisconsin, who have the same number of electoral votes, Wisconsin being a red state, Maryland a blue state in the last election, if they both agreed, they could go on their own to going by the winner of the national popular vote rather than the vote of Marylanders. The thing that could potentially be maybe a little bit distasteful about this is if, let's say, Maryland went to Kamala Harris and Trump won the popular vote, and then Maryland's votes went to Trump. So I can see people being mad about that. But otherwise, it's a way to try to shift the move to the popular vote more quickly.
And Ovita Wiggins, do you get a sense that in the bubble in which we live, the Baltimore-Washington corridor, that there is, you know, strong support for abandoning the Electoral College? I mean, most of that support, ginned up pretty highly after the last election in 2016, when the popular vote winner was not declared president by the Electoral College.
Yeah, I know. Obviously, there's actually legislation in Colorado. They're actually also moving towards doing taking on similar legislation that Maryland is considering. So I think that there, as you said, following Donald Trump's win in 2016, a number of states are sort of moving in the same direction. And in Colorado, they're sort of fast-tracking their piece of legislation to join the states in picking a president by popular vote.
Yeah, and it's interesting how they're pairing the states, you know, Maryland and Wisconsin, because what if in 2020 Wisconsin becomes a blue state, as many people thought it might have been the last time? Then does that mean the pairing doesn't work? And were legislation to pass, you wonder what that would mean at that juncture. Luke, before we take a break, another voting-related bill. This is Brooke Learman, a delegate from Baltimore City, has withdrawn a bill that would have allowed the city of Baltimore to have some different options for voting, including what's known as ranked choice voting. That's something that folks are doing in Maine these days. What was her bill going to do, and why did she decide to withdraw it?
Well, her bill would have enabled the city council to do two things. One, move to an open primary system, which a lot of people in the council want and they've asked for. That would be the case where, you know, Maryland's a dominant Democratic city. It's 10-1 Democrats, and so the Democratic primary really determines the winner of the mayor's race and council races. And this would allow, say, Republicans, Green Party members, Libertarians, unaffiliated people to vote in that primary. The other option was to move to ranked choice voting. Right now, when we have a crowded a primary for mayor, the winner doesn't necessarily get above 50%. That happened with Mayor Catherine Pugh. In her last win, she had, I think, like 37% of the vote. And this would then go to people's second choice and third choice on the ballot to determine the true winner. And once somebody got above 50%, then they could become mayor. Those proposals were, she withdrew them because it didn't have enough votes on the city delegation. She said she was a couple of votes short. It would need the city delegation support to advance to the full assembly. It didn't have that, and so she said she's going to try again in future years.
Yeah, the ranked choice idea is really interesting. It kind of reminds me of when you buy a book or something on Amazon. It'll say, you know, people who read this book also liked, and then, you know, and you have your second and third choices that you can actually put on the ballot. Luke Broadwater covers the State House for the Baltimore Sun. Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics and government for the Washington Post. We'll have more on the goings-on in Annapolis after a quick break. You are welcome to join our conversation if you have questions for Ovita Wiggins or Luke Broadwater. 410-662-87 780 is our phone number. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby joins me to talk about a new program to promote victim and witness services. The new initiative will include an ad campaign and an app designed to encourage victims and witnesses to come forward and testify in criminal trials. Plus, I'm going to speak with Baltimore Museum of Art curator Oliver Schell about the museum's new exhibition of surrealist masterworks called Monsters and Myths, Surrealism and War in the 1930s and 1940s. And we'll pay tribute to Baltimore's First Lady of Jazz, Ethel Ennis. The 86-year-old singer, composer, and pianist passed away last weekend. We'll listen to a couple of rare recordings of the legendary artist and excerpts from some of the conversations Ethel and I had over the years here on WYPR. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we are running down the latest from the Maryland General Assembly's legislative session. My guests are Washington Post Maryland State Politics reporter Ovita Wiggins and the Baltimore Sun State House reporter Luke Broadwater. So he's one of two State House reporters, along with Pam Wood. You can join our conversation if you have questions for Ovita Wiggins or Luke Broadwater at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Luke, let me ask you about the $15 minimum wage. I understand that there's a Senate committee scheduled to hold a hearing today, actually. So that is that's moving through, it looks like.
Yes, that's right. The House had a lengthy hearing on it, I think, 2 weeks ago, and the Senate is having their hearing today. My colleague, Pamela Wood, as you mentioned, has been following this issue closely for us. It has the support of both of leadership of both houses, which is in Maryland, the Democrats control the General Assembly, and if Mike Bush and Mike Miller both want something to pass, it's going to pass. So they both come on the record and they've said, we want the $15 minimum wage, we want to pass this year. That said, I think the issue will be the amendments and tinkering with whether it's the phase-in period, whether it applies to everyone across the board, whether there are geographical carve-outs. And I think the battle is really going to be between the members of sort of the left part of the party that want a clean bill, $15 for everybody no matter what, and maybe some of the more centrist members who want these amendments. And I think that we'll start seeing things move and really speed up after this hearing, and maybe we'll see it start to advance towards the floor votes perhaps in the next week or two.
And Ovita Wiggins, you had two really interesting stories in the Post concerning gender identity and sexual orientation. The first is that there is a proposal to have gender-neutral IDs issued in the state of Maryland. How would that work?
So Maryland would become one of six states that would allow gender-neutral driver's licenses. If a person requested someone who is non-binary, which that is someone who does not identify as either male or female, would be able to when they apply for their driver's license, they would be able to have an X on their identification card instead of an M for male or F for female. This legislation, it passed on yesterday. There was an initial approval by the state Senate, and it's supposed to come up for final approval on Friday. It's interesting because similar legislation had been introduced last year in the House, but it was withdrawn, and not sure whether the changes in the legislature, how the legislature has moved towards the left a little bit this past election, whether that had anything to do with the fact that the legislation appears to be moving forward this year.
And you quote in your story Minority Leader J.B. Jennings, who's a Republican from Harford County, who said, quote, are we going to call them X-Men? And the Republicans tended to complain about it as the designation being inaccurate. They didn't seem to really even accept the notion that some people are gender non-binary identified. They're saying mm-hmm. you know, everybody's going to be one way or the other eventually, so that's what their license should say. This is mm-hmm. clearly a philosophical divide, but is it coming down along party lines? Is there consensus about this on the Democratic side of the aisle?
Well, it's interesting. When yesterday, when the bill passed, they took it by a voice vote as opposed to a roll call. So we don't know exactly. We will know on Friday whether it comes down to party lines. But it, based on the questions that came up on yesterday, it appears as though it is a partisan issue.
And you did also have an interesting story about a private school, the National Christian Academy, where there's a student, a little boy, who has two mothers who are separated or divorced, I guess. But still, mm-hmm. There was an invitation for a Mother's Day tea at the school, and the school limited each kid to just one mother. And the two women who are the parents of this little kid objected. What happened there?
Yeah, the incident involving the two mothers was cited during a hearing on a bill that would allow private schools to be sued over any instances of discrimination. Currently, under current law, if a parent sends their child to private school, and they allege discrimination, they would not be able to sue the school. And so the ACLU, which is pushing this bill and has pushed it in the past, learned of this family situation in Prince George's County and shared the experience with legislators. It's unclear whether the bill will move this year, but many of the advocates are hoping that sharing this story as well as talking about some of the language that is included on handbooks of some of the schools that they find to be discriminatory, that legislators will possibly move on the legislation this year.
And Luke Broadwater, it's interesting that, this issue is percolating up in this session. Here's the governor, a longtime supporter of school choice and vouchers for private schools like the National Christian Academy. It's interesting. How does that particular history play in and inform the legislature's current consideration of this kind of thing?
Yeah, you're right that Governor Hogan is a big supporter of charter schools. He had a press conference earlier this year in which he announced money to try to boost charter schools. He's got a bill that would increase their per pupil funding, would also set aside some money for construction projects and rehab work at some of these aging charter schools around the state. So he sees himself, I think, clearly in the camp of like trying to boost and support the charters. The teachers union is very much against that, what he's trying to do, and they've put out some blistering statements about how he is trying to basically redirect money away from public schools to the public charters. The governor says these are these are public schools too. They're just run in a different way, and they deserve this funding. So there is an ideological divide there between the governor and the advocates of traditional public schools.
Luke Broadwater covers Annapolis for the Baltimore Sun, along with his colleague Pam Wood. Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics and Annapolis for the Washington Post, along with her colleague Aaron Cox. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall, 410-662-8780. If you want to jump in, our email midday@wypr.org, and you can always drop us a tweet at Midday. WYPR. So, Ovita, speaking of schools, the issue of when the school year should start for K through 12 students in Maryland has come to the fore again. The governor issued an executive order just telling everybody it's going to start after Labor Day, whether you like it or not, a couple of years ago, and some people are voicing objections. Where does that stand?
The Senate gave final approval to a bill that would overturn the governor's executive order. They took that action last week, so that legislation has moved to the House. As you would expect, that vote was along party lines. It was 31. It actually was 31-13 because there were some members who were absent that day. But it now will be heard in the House, and there is a chance that this particular, actually, it's interesting because Senate President on earlier this week from the floor said something. He said he wanted to give a message to the governor in regards to this piece of legislation, because the governor has talked about moving forward with a referendum requiring voters to decide whether school should start after Labor Day or not. And basically what the Senate president said from the floor was, it was the day of the snow on yesterday, actually. He said, I just want to let the governor to know that several school districts, Montgomery, I think he mentioned Howard and Anne Arundel, have already used up their school days this year, which will mean that those school districts are likely to lose their spring break this year. And so he just wanted to let him know that, you know, let's not move forward with this referendum that you're talking about and just allow the local districts to be able to decide whether to start before or after Labor Day.
And Luke Broadwater, is it kind of like the minimum wage? I mean, there are people saying that rather than make it a statewide law, a statute that everybody in every jurisdiction pays a minimum wage of $15, that you could, you know, calibrate it for various localities. Are there people saying that, you know, simply we should let each local district decide when school starts and when school ends, and it's really not the state's business to be involved in that? But the governor, on the other hand, cites great public support for the notion of starting school after Labor Day.
Yeah, what you just described is exactly what the Democratic bill would do. It would return local control on this issue to each school system. So, you know, some school systems could elect to maintain the post-Labor Day start if they desire. Others could move it up. People could have a longer spring break, shorter spring break. They could bake in more snow days to their calendar or fewer. Each jurisdiction could handle it themselves. It is interesting because I think the local control argument has typically been one made by Republicans on other pieces of legislation. So now Democrats are adopting it on this issue, which they think helps carry the day. The governor, of course, is very committed to this post-Labor Day start. He calls it one of the two most popular things he's done as governor. It's something that Controller Peter Franchot had long wanted, and once Governor Hogan took office, he joined him in that. He says the people wanted lower tolls and they wanted the post-Labor Day start, and I delivered on both those things, and the lawmakers are acting against the will of the public. So those are sort of the two sides of the debate.
And Ovita Wiggins, we have an email from a listener, Michelle, who says, how will marking an X on a license, this is going back to gender-neutral IDs, how will marking an X on a license work if it's used at IDs at like airports and other locations that don't recognize the designation? Has anybody brought that up?
Actually, several major airlines have decided to move forward with allowing people to identify as unspecified when they buy tickets. One of the things that the bill sponsor, Senator Smith, brought up as well was the fact that there, as I mentioned before, that there are five other states that have passed similar legislation allowing people to mark an X. I think some of those states, California, Maine, and also the Homeland Security actually recognizes the X as a, you know, Homeland Security has recognized it, as well as 11 other countries actually have allow people to identify as unspecified.
Luke Broadwater, Delegate Cheryl Glenn, who's the former chair of the Legislative Black Caucus, is kind of ignoring the will of the Baltimore City School Board, reintroducing a bill that would allow school resource officers to be armed. But the school board is not on board with that by any means. What's going on there?
Yes, that's right. So this has been something that's been tried for several years. It's something the City School Police Union wants, and that is to allow them to carry their firearms while inside the school buildings. Right now, they're allowed to carry them outside, and they have to lock them up while they're inside the school. They view this as a detriment to them. If someone does come in with a gun, if there is a mass shooting, how can they quickly get their firearm and respond? But the school board does not want this. They've been they voted 10-0 earlier this year to oppose this legislation. And when they did that earlier this session, Delegate Glenn withdrew her bill. Since that time, there was the shooting inside of Frederick Douglass High, where a staff member was shot. And she said, after seeing that, she decided she was no longer going to defer to the school board. She reintroduced the bill on Wednesday, and she said she's going to force a vote of the city delegation so that every member of the public can see up or down, yes or no, where each one of the delegates stands on this issue.
Does she have a sense of the, for example, the city delegation? I mean, leaving the school board itself aside, how about the delegation that represents Baltimore City?
I think that's going to be a hotly debated issue. I personally haven't polled the whole delegation. I did that on the Hopkins police. There's 22 of them, so I haven't gotten to all of them yet. But I know there are some who've spoken out against it. Mary Washington, for instance, said more guns in school doesn't make anybody safer. Delegate Glenn, Delegate Kurt Anderson, some others, I think from maybe the more old school or traditional wing of the Democratic Party, think it does. They think that the left wing of the party has become too maybe anti-police and see any police officer with a gun as a force for bad and not good, and they disagree with that. They think that these guys could do something good if they had guns. I don't know how the split's going to come down, and it probably won't go to the city delegation for at least a couple of weeks because it's now in the Rules Committee because it was introduced late because of the whole thing with her withdrawing it and then bringing it back. So this Friday, however, we will see testimony on the Hopkins police force, which perhaps will give us an indication about how people are feeling about increased law enforcement and increased armed law enforcement in Baltimore City.
And while we're on that subject, Luke, you had a piece that talked about some pretty high-profile names advocating in favor of Hopkins having its own private police force, Congressman Cummings, Mayor Pugh, but there's still by no means any consensus. Speaking of Mary Washington, freshman senator from Baltimore, she's one of the people who's particularly opposed to it, and that's part of the district that she represents, at least the Homewood campus up here in Baltimore. What do you give the chances of that bill making it through in this session?
I really don't know. I think it's going to be really close. I have some people on the record speaking against it. I have some people on the record speaking for it. But the vast majority of the 22 delegates and senators from the city that I approached about this said they were undecided still. So a lot of them are waiting to hear from their community associations who are currently taking votes on the issue. And I think the community associations can be really influential here. A delegate or a senator gets back, you know, three-fourths or a majority of their community associations who are opposed or for it, I think that's really going to influence them because those are their voters. That said, there is a pretty intense lobbying effort on behalf of Hopkins down here. I think they have 8 lobbyists. And, you know, just over the weekend, last weekend, Sandy Rosenberg, who had previously told me he was undecided, emailed me to tell me he was now a yes vote. So maybe they're getting a little momentum for the bill. At the same time, like Senator Corey McCrae and others say, I want to see major changes. I'm not a hard no. I would vote for it, but we got to see some big changes to this legislation. We need more money for youth funding. We need greater restrictions on where the police can patrol. We need to have a more independence in the oversight board. And if they alter the bill more, maybe they will bring more people on board.
We just have a few minutes left. We have a call from Lee, who is at the State House in Annapolis, evidently going to be testifying at the State House. Lee, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what's on your mind?
Sure. Well, our advocacy group, Trans Healthcare Maryland, we're a community group of transgender and non-binary persons, and we're here today at the House of Delegates to testify in support of HB 421. That would provide transgender and non-binary Marylanders with an XID option and the ability to self-attest to our gender, just as cisgender persons like yourself would be able to do when getting a driver's license or a state ID.
What chances do you think the bill has?
We're feeling really good about this bill. We have a lot of support from constituents, as well as the bill is well-sponsored and has a companion bill in the Senate. The hearing for that was 2 weeks ago, so we're feeling really positive about it. Maryland has a chance to join other states and jurisdictions in providing attestation and this option for their residents, and we're excited for the possibility. Think that things are looking strong.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Lee. I appreciate it. And Ovita Wiggins, this is pretty consistent with your reporting on this. Washington, D.C., the district, back in 2017 allowed this. And you mentioned six other states around the country are doing it. I mean, are you feeling a groundswell at all?
That was for me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Was that for me or
yeah.
The caller? Okay.
Well, for you.
Yeah, I think that as I said, that this the bill had not moved in the Senate before. It actually didn't even have a Senate sponsor before. And so just the fact that it received preliminary approval on yesterday and appears to it'll be on the agenda on tomorrow for a final approval in the Senate. And as the caller said, a companion bill is being heard in the House this afternoon.
Before we go, we have a listener from Parkton who wants to know, are there any juvenile justice reform bills up for consideration that will bring Maryland in line with the 2018 Supreme Court decision that juveniles being sentenced to life without parole is unconstitutional except in extreme circumstances? I'm not aware that either of you have written about that specifically, but in terms of juvenile justice reform, is that on the minds of anybody down there?
I know that there is a bill out there that would deal with this issue. It just has not moved forward, and it wasn't a part of the Democratic agenda, but there is legislation out there.
Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics for The Washington Post. Luke Broadwater is the State House reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Thanks to you both. Really appreciate your reporting, and as always, appreciate your time here on Midday. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up, Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick has her weekly theater review. We're going to talk about The King and I at the Hippodrome Theater here in Baltimore. That's coming up after this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.